You are listening to The New Man, Beyond the Macho Jerk and the New Age Wimp. Your host is men's coach and group facilitator, Trip Lanier. He is joined in the studio by the show's producer, Casey Capshaw.
What can we learn from a Marine veteran who's been in the shit? How can lessons learned on the battlefield apply to your life and mine? And what is the single biggest factor that allows you to bounce back from adversity? This week, Casey and I talk with Dan Taslitz. He's a Marine reconnaissance veteran and team leader at OneFreedom.org. In this episode, he shares his lessons learned in Iraq and how he teaches others to cope with extreme stress. Welcome to The New Man. Today we're talking with Dan Taslitz, and I'm going to let him tell us a bit about what he does. Welcome, Dan.
Good to be here. I am a consultant and lead trainer with One Freedom Incorporated, which is a nonprofit that works with service members, both active and veterans who have left the service and their families, and also the care providers that work with that population. And we basically are developing and designing education and training models that help them effectively resource their strength and discharge any kind of embodied stress from their experiences of deployment. But it's really, it's an educational model. So we're teaching them about the neurophysiology of stress, how the body just naturally reacts to high intensity environments. And we also help support and educate their families around that, because the family also goes through a stress spectrum in terms of having their loved ones deployed. So really the whole model is to strengthen the individual, to provide more resilience in the face of stress or intense experiences, and then to make an effective bridge for them to come back to their families, their communities, and bring the strength of their experience with them.
And this model is not limited to people who've been deployed in combat situations in the military, correct?
Definitely not. I mean, the model itself is actually applicable to every population that works in a high-intensity environment. So for us right now, our sole focus is on veterans and the military population. But our long-term focus is actually to support all populations. So particularly physicians, emergency room personnel, first responders, police, fire, anyone who, as part of their daily life and work, engaging with, you know, high stress, challenging environments.
Beautiful. Yeah. Very valuable. On my end, my father went to Vietnam, and then he went straight into being a law enforcement officer for 30-something years. And I don't think he's had anything like this.
Right.
And I've been in experiences with him where I got what his worldview was really like and how he reacted to a certain scenario where he hadn't really gotten to, how to download a new healthy way of being in the world. Does that resonate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, there are two ways that intense experiences can affect us. They can either break us down or they can build us up. And the reality is that human beings need stress. We need stress. It's part of the way we're built. And we need a certain amount of stress in order to continue to grow and evolve as individuals and as members of a community. We're designed that way. But you have to have resilience to be able to effectively engage with whatever the experience is. And the more that you grow with those experiences, the more effectively you can engage, the more resilience you have, the more intense experiencing you can sustain. So for instance, if in childhood you are raised in like a perfect bubble world where nothing ever goes wrong and you never stub your toe and you're, you know, perfectly loved and supported, then when you get out of that bubble, which you will at some point, life is going to kick your ass, because you don't have any experience of your own ability to be in adversity and survive. But like most of us, I would say probably all of us, if your childhood instead has challenge, stress, your family may not be perfect, you maybe fall down, hurt yourself, or you get bullied at school, or whatever it is. I mean, there's such a high spectrum. If it works well, then you titrate those experiences. So, you know, you fall down and you realize, oh, I can fall down, I'm not going to kill myself. I can hurt, you know, it's pain, or I scratch myself and I bleed, but no big deal. I can go on. And then maybe later on, you're athletic and you break your leg skiing or whatever. You heal, you move on. That builds resilience. That builds your capacity to understand that your survival is not at stake by being in a high challenging, high threat environment. The reality of life is that all of us are going to have stress, and potentially all of us are going to experience trauma in our lives at some point. It might be just the death of a loved one, just from old age. It could be you get assaulted. It could be you're in a car accident. I mean, for most of us, it's happened at one point or another. All of that can be traumatic, but the hallmark of trauma is a lack of resilience and a component of helplessness. You can't effectively respond to the experience. So resilience is about self-empowerment in the face of challenge or stress or intense experiencing. If you have a sense of I'm in control of, you know, my experience on some level, I mean, you know, I may not be in control if my car runs off the road or somebody hits me, but if I'm in control of my own response to that environment and I understand what that response is, that gives me a sense of personal empowerment in the face of the challenge. And then it's not traumatizing.
Let me ask you something. You said something just a minute ago about how we need stress, and I got that there was this fork in the road. So an event happens. Maybe we have a choice, maybe we don't, I don't know, but we're either going to become more resilient because of this event, or we're going to kind of go down a downward spiral. What happens that would create us or help us be more resilient or go the other way?
Right. So I would say we always have a choice, actually. We may not have a choice about the actual experience in terms of, you know, you don't choose to get in a car wreck or whatever. But we always have a choice in terms of how we interact with that experience. And that is the determining factor of whether it becomes traumatic and debilitating or whether it becomes a resource that makes us stronger. And the tools that you use are really to understand how we as human beings respond to stress. That's first. And that really is a question of neurophysiology. It's like, how do the brain and body respond to high impact, highly intense experiences? If you understand that, one, it normalizes the response. So you realize, oh, I'm not screwed up. There's nothing defective in me. I'm not like screwed up by feeling this way, whatever that is.
This is just stress.
It's just stress.
Or high stress.
Or it's just my body's response to stress. So the understanding comes first. Then the next step is to effectively engage with that response. And that takes some training, but really it's about mindfulness. And that is the underpinning of martial traditions, martial arts. It's the underpinning of a lot of embodiment practices, which are really effective strengthening paths to take as a man or just as a human being who is going to, you know, you're going to have to deal with stress in your life. When you talk about stress or trauma, there is chronic and acute. Acute is a car accident. Bam! It's an unexpected experience of, you know, very high intensity, high stress, whatever, but it's limited in time. The impact of that experience depends on the intensity of it and your level of resourcing and resilience in the face of it. Okay. Now, the chronic are things that are over time. They have longer duration. They're not short duration. So, you know, chronic stress can be just being in a high stress job, an EMT or an ER physician, or
day to day, there's just always this kind of level of anxiety could be happening.
Or somebody who was, you know, as a child had to deal with molestation or some kind of physical abuse over time. That's chronic trauma or chronic stress. And they need to be dealt with a little bit differently, but the same physiology is in play. So we're just going to talk about an acute experience, which is like a combat experience, actually.
Okay.
First, you know, your brain starts operating at a much higher level. And what that means is all of your senses, all of your sensations become much more acute, much sharper. Your hearing, your vision, your visual acuity, your smell, your relationship to, you know, the situation around you. Along with that, your vigilance, your reactivity, and this is the fight or flight response. And this happens, it doesn't matter if you're in combat or not. It happens when you get in a car accident. It happens when somebody jumps out of a corner and screams in your face and you don't expect it. You get the same kind of animal response to the environment, and it's good. It's a survival response, and it'll keep you alive. The problem is that what happens is your brain effectively registers everything in the environment around you when that happens. And that's a good survival response too, because you want to remember if you're, you know, if we
don't do this again.
Yeah. Or if we were an animal running through the jungle and a tiger jumped out and we got away from it, we want to remember the smell just before it jumped. We want to remember the sounds, and all of those cues are registered in a way so that when we're walking through the jungle again and suddenly it sounds this way or it smells this certain way, we're going to be ready for the tiger. Mm. The problem is that happens all the time, and it may not be a life-threatening experience. We're still going to register it that way. So it's good to understand that that's the neurological response to a high-stress experience. I keep saying stress instead of trauma just because trauma carries a stigma, a load of stigma in terms of the connotation.
Okay, got it.
But that's what we're talking about. I mean, that's the spectrum of what we're talking about.
All right.
So when that happens, one, you become very alive. You're right there in the moment. But two, you log everything in. And then depending on if your resilience is stronger than the experience or the experience is stronger than your resilience, you'll either come out of it feeling like, okay, I'm alive, I'm okay, I can go on, or you'll go into a freeze response, which is the third option in terms of the limbic system, where if you can't effectively resolve the experience, fight or flight, right? You fight off the threat or you escape the threat, then you shut down, you freeze. And it's like the possum who plays dead.
Mm.
It's that freeze response, actually. And the freeze response, it's also a survival response, but this is the response that is most connected to trauma in the body and in our lives. You can't effectively resolve the situation. There's no fighting off the threat. There's no escaping the threat. And so instead, you shut down. And you shut down on a very fundamental level. And that shutdown also locks in all of those cues that are tied to that experience or the moment of that experience. And then, from then on, every time you run into one of those cues, it brings the experience back up. So it actually takes the past and pushes it into the present. So the past actually overlays the present. And you're not now, you're not in your body, you're not in the moment. So getting back, I know this was kind of a long roundabout journey, but getting back to your question, like how do you effectively engage when you get to that fork in the road where something big happens and you have to respond? If you understand the way your body is working, your first step in responding is actually to take a breath. It's that simple. You take a deep breath. Breath brings you into your body. Breath is the portal to effectively working with your body in that moment. And it's also a doorway into your strength to be able to respond effectively to whatever the environment is thrown in your face. So being able to breathe, and there's lots of different forms of breath work, but just being able to breathe fully into your chest, into your abdomen, is going to bring you into your body. The next step is to apply your attentional control to the experience of your body in that moment. Once you're breathing into the moment, then you need to bring your awareness into that space as well. There are a variety of responses that are going to happen. First of all, your cognitive kind of executive function in terms of your cognitive brain is going to shut down.
So if you're not really thinking in that moment.
Exactly. Because in the face of a threat or, you know, whatever the stress or trauma is, we're going to go back to our mid and brainstem, our midbrain and our brainstem, our limbic system, the emotional kind of center of our brain and body. And again, that's a good survival response because that's going to gear us up to fight or run. It's the way that's where, you know, adrenaline, cortisol in the blood, it's going to get us ready to go. So what we want to do is, knowing that that's going to happen, we want strategies around how to effectively engage in a way that brings us back into cognition, back into a thinking state in the face of whatever the threat is. Because if you're not in a thinking state, you can only respond as an animal, basically, which can be an effective response, actually, at times, but you want to be able to make choices, that's all. You want to be able to make choices. If you're in a reactive state, if you can only respond based on instinctual, just like fight or flight mechanism, then it's likely you're not going to be doing the best thing in the environment. And this happens in combat where people respond with too much force or with indirect force, and there can be collateral damage or casualties, you know, and it's going to happen. Once you've been through a combat experience, it's very difficult to put a lot of value judgment around it, because we train our military people really well. They're really well trained to be in that kind of environment and respond effectively and professionally. However, we're still human beings. And that fundamental response of the mind and body will override the kind of training that people get at a certain point. So what we want to do then is give people the additional training to effectively embody their response and tap into their own strength and resourcing in the face of threat or trauma or stress.
I love what you said about the needing stress thing. And there's a question around, like, is that what draws someone into the military in hopes of having one of these heightened experiences?
That's a great question. I think that the military serves a lot of functions for people. I think fundamentally it is a place to serve, and that people that go into the military are drawn to service, serving their country or serving a sense of their own potential, their own calling to continue to grow. It is one path of warriorship. It's one of the accepted paths of warriorship in our culture is to go into the military. I don't think it's the only path, but it is one. Now, the thing with the military is that it's only half of the picture. One of the keystones, I think, of a warrior's path is to be able to effectively engage with discipline, with challenge, with that component of transformation that requires a lot of will and the willingness to move beyond your capacity, to move beyond your envelope. That's something that the military provides in its training and in its job. I mean,
was that something that drew you in? Was that being able to have choice in the face of that adversity?
Yeah, well, so for me, my background was actually in wilderness education and as a mountain guide for years before I went into the military. So I mean, my path has always been choosing challenge, actually. Either choosing challenge in the mountains or choosing challenge in the ocean or, you know, finding ways to constantly push a little further. And, you know, what I realized was that I could never find the end of my envelope, really. I mean,
So no matter what you did, it was like, that's not it. It's got to be...
Yeah, I would always, you know, I would think, okay, so this is my limit. But then just choosing to be in an environment that demands more of you, I discover, oh, that's not my limit. Like, I can push further if I have to. So I chose a life that would demand that of me. I chose that because I wanted to constantly keep expanding my capacity to understand the human experience, to understand my own experience. And I didn't want it to be limited by just, I didn't want it to be limited at all, actually. I wanted to experience the full spectrum, everything from more mindful, contemplative stuff to really out there. I spent 16 years in the martial arts and, you know, developed a lot of practice around that. Did a lot of yoga to try to understand that. Did some meditation practices. Was in the wilderness, high altitude mountaineering, working in the oceans, and then the military was just a natural progression for me. I mean, I've always had a fascination with the military. I always wanted to be there. My dad served. I wanted to serve in terms of honorable service. I wanted to push myself as far as I could go. And so, getting back to your initial question, at least for me, it was the desire to explore my masculine expression in the context of warriorship. And the martial arts did that for me, and the military was the next step for that for me. Again, I don't think it's the only step you can take at all, but it was an important one for me.
And you had combat experience, did you ever have this moment of like, I've arrived, or was that, tell us a little bit about your experience in combat and how it relates to your path.
Right. So I went in, and I went into the most difficult specialty that I could find, and I was in the reserves. So I actually had the choice, and now looking back, I wish I had just gone regular because it would have been much easier than being a reservist. But that was because of what I went into was reconnaissance in the Marine Corps, and reconnaissance is the special operations wing in the Marine Corps. So I spent a lot of time on active duty, actually. I think a lot of reservists can be 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks a year. But for us, it was months deployed and on active duty every year, either with training, primarily with training. But what I was great was I got to serve with really some of the best Marines in the Corps. All the people that I interacted with, whether in reconnaissance or not, were great, great warriors, really good Marines. I met some of the finest men that I've met anywhere in the military.
And did you share that sense of being on the path, like these are other men that are wanting this experience too, like that kind of camaraderie, or were you still alone in your desire?
No, we were drawn there for a variety of reasons, but when you get to, in this case, reconnaissance or any special operations community, it's a self-selecting population in that you have to go through a lot to be there. You can't just say, I want this, and then you're there. You actually have to go through lots of really challenging schools and tests, and you got to jump through a lot of hoops, and they're trying to knock you down basically at every milepost, because the only people they want there are the ones that are really want to be there, first of all, and that have the strength and intelligence and resilience to operate in that environment, which is a very intense environment. So reconnaissance, you're designed to operate in very small teams, behind the lines, far from support, and in a clandestine, you know, operating capacity. So that was what I went in for, and that's what I was trained for. Deployed to Iraq, and we were used in a variety of roles. We were used in direct action roles, which is where you're following intelligence, going and trying to take down, like you remember the deck of cards thing. There was a list of high-value targets, HVTs in Iraq, and anytime we get intelligence on somebody, we would go and basically try to capture them. And so that could be assaulting a structure, a house, a building, to root them out, to find those people. So we did that. We did clandestine ops where we were operating at night. And, you know, we were really looking, we were hunting the insurgents. That's what we did in the area that we operated in. And I operated around Fallujah and in the center of Al Anbar province.
And that was a tough area back in 2004, 2005.
Yeah. There was a lot going on. My combat experiences, you know, they were no more or less than others. I think they were probably less intense than a number of people have experienced over there, mainly because we operated, because we were a clandestine unit, we weren't actually going out to engage the enemy. We were going out to find him, take him down, either bring him in or, you know, eliminate him if we had to. But so our engagements were short and sharp. Got hit with a bunch of IEDs, got some ambushes, but no big encounters.
So in those events, I'm just curious to kind of relate it back to your path and your story of like, is this it? I'm just getting like, is this it, what I'm looking for? Did that ever happen to you, for you?
No. Yes and no. Actually, that's
you just the, saved a lot of men.
Like, the non-answer
maybe I'll find
answer.
It in Iraq.
Yeah, well, yeah. So here's what I found. I found my limit. It actually pushed me there. And so on the one side, it wasn't the like transforming experience that I wanted it to be in terms of going into the shadow and really discovering my strength there that I could bring home. But I did discover a lot of power in that experience, mainly because of the men I served with. And going through that type of experience with, you know, other people, in this case men in the platoon and in my team, it's hard to describe, but it's a very powerful opportunity for transcendence in a way. Transcend your own kind of personal selfish outlook on the world, because suddenly you're in an environment, and this is the power of the military for me, you're in an environment where the team is what counts. It's your connection to each other that counts, because that's what keeps you alive. It's not, you know, it's not Rambo going out there alone and tearing shit up. It's a team going out, a team of mutual support to accomplish very difficult, challenging missions that cannot be accomplished alone, absolutely cannot be accomplished alone. So you rely 100% for your survival on the people around you, and they rely on you.
it feels like you went from it really being an I experience to the thing that you learned was that it's a we experience.
That's it.
Someone told me recently they were studying social networking, and they said that they were talking about some study, and I'll have to find the study, but someone did a study of all these special forces men, and the study was to find out what had guys fail and what had guys succeed. And the one factor wasn't aerobics or anything that could be kind of attributed to on a personal level, but it was their connection to the group. Even if they were in a certain, even if they were alone in whatever test they were in, their strength in being a part of the group was the single most important factor in their resiliency.
That's right.
Does that land?
That's absolutely right. The reconnaissance in the Marine Corps has the lowest statistical incidence of PTSD of any military specialty in the Marines. And the reason for that, what they think, is team cohesion. Because we operate in small teams, because independent of other units, and the nature of the training creates very strong bonds among the team members, that's what they feel is actually the source of that strength in the face of adversity.
Mm. And so you went from the I kind of perspective of my path and my warriorship to getting into more of a we perspective. And then you came back. Did you want to go back? How was your transition back to being here?
Yeah. So the kind of like resourcing, mindfulness, strength training that I'm doing with military veterans and service members now is, I didn't have that. Right. I didn't have that when I went over, but I did have a lot of training, some of the best training that's available. And I was working with amazing guys. So we did really well, but we had a very high op tempo. So we were in the field. Well, the vast majority of the time we were there. I mean, we'd be out for a week or 2 weeks and then we'd come back into a base environment and have maybe a 24-hour turnaround and then out again. So for us, we were really geared up for our environment. You don't sleep much. You get what you can, but you might not sleep for days, or you get, you know, an hour or two here and there. And when you do sleep, it's a very shallow sleep, a superficial sleep, because sleep is, you know, dangerous. And so you tend to sleep at a shallow sleep. You can come out of quickly. You don't sleep much. You're very hypervigilant. You're constantly scanning the environment for threats. You're really alive, like it's kind of a vibrant way to be for a while, but you get burnt out over time if you don't have an effective way to recharge the cycle to recover, you know, your sense of balance, basically. If you're always in this hyper-aroused state, which is, you know, its nervous system has sympathetic and parasympathetic arms, which is medical term, sympathy. It doesn't have anything to do with sympathy. It's just the sympathetic nervous system is the speed-up system. It's what gets you, the adrenaline gets you going. The parasympathetic is the slow down system, and that's what lets you go to sleep. It's what lets you calm down and, you know, whatever, breathe deep. You need a balance of those to be a really effective, what I would say a really effective warrior, but a really effective participant in high intensity, you know, environments. But we were always up, and that's the norm. In the combat theater.
You get addicted to that, being in that state?
Well, yeah. You don't get addicted like it's a drug, but your body gets tuned to it. Your brain gets tuned to it. So in that sense, yeah, that becomes your center of gravity, okay? So it's very hard to move away from that into a more relaxed state because it pulls you right back. Mm-hmm. And so that was the thing. So we worked very hard. By the end, we were all getting burnt out. Our performance was starting to decline, which happens. That's just the way it works. And then you come back from that environment and suddenly you're home, you're here with friends and family, but you're actually not here. Your body and your brain are still there. And I'm not talking about flashbacks or, you know, anything like this. I'm just talking about the way that we're neurologically tuned. We're tuned for an environment, for a combat environment, and you don't turn that off like a light switch.
Join us next week as we continue our conversation with Dan. We'll learn about integrating trauma and the secrets to building true strength.